In the Great Hall of the Justice League, there are assembled the world's four greatest heroes, created from the cosmic legends of the universe. Superman. Wonder Woman. Batman. Aquaman. And those three junior super friends, Wendy, Marvin, and Wonder Dog. Their mission, to fight injustice, to right that which is wrong, and to serve all mankind.
Hello, and welcome to another exciting episode of For All Mankind, a Super Friends podcast. For All Mankind is a read-through show covering DC Comics' classic Super Friends series, which ran for 47 issues from 1976 to 1981. Proud member of the Fire and Water Podcast Network, I'm your host, Rob Kelly, and joining me this episode is my super friend from the Batgirl to Oracle and Professor Frenzy podcasts, Chris. Hi, Chris.
Hi, Rob. How are you?
I'm doing great. Thanks for coming on the show.
Rob, thank you very much. I'm a huge fan of this show and all your work. I'm very, very honored to be here.
Oh, well, thank you. I appreciate it. Like I said, you and I have been exchanging back and forth on Twitter for a long time, but we've never had a chance to podcast before, so this is always exciting to talk to somebody kind of brand new in a way.
Oh, I'm very, very honored to be here.
All right, very cool. Well, like I said, we're here to talk about Super Friends number 4, which is Riddles and Rockets by E. Nelson Birdwell, Ramona Fraiden, Bob Smith, and Danny O'Neill. But before we get to that, Chris, since this is your first time on the show, I want to ask you, like, do you have any particular history with the Super Friends comic book?
Yes, I do. I was, with the Super Friends in general, too. Rob, I was 6 years old when the Super Friends debuted on a Saturday morning TV back in 1973, and it was an instant must-watch series for me, you know, waking up early and having my bowl of breakfast cereal at the ready. You know, and I think I was right at that sweet spot age for the show. I was growing up and living in Memphis at the time, and they really didn't rerun the 60s Batman or the Marvel Super Heroes cartoons, and they just stopped showing reruns of the 60s Spider-Man cartoons, so I was very, very hungry for any comic book-related media. As far as the comic books go, I started reading Richie Rich comics and other DC and Marvel comics like Batman and Spider-Man almost a year before the show debuted, but I missed out on the first issues of titles of, say, like Shazam and Marvel Team-Up, so it was something of a pretty big deal when the first issue of Super Friends came out. I was 9 years old, and it was the summer of 1976, and I saw a DC Comics house ad for not one, not two, but three new comics, all based on TV shows that I watched and really liked. We had Isis, and that issue came out, number one came out on July 15th, and that was based on the heroine on the Saturday morning TV series. You had Welcome Back, Cotter, which was coming out on August 5th. Now, that was based on the sitcom with John Travolta. That was the show I was really digging. And you had Super Friends, and that was coming out on August 26th, and I wanted to have them all, and I got them all, and I really wanted Super Friends. I remember getting Super Friends number one, Rob. It was a very, very hot Saturday afternoon, and I got it from a Memphis 7-Eleven spinner rack. And just being beyond giddy and blown away, you had all these heroes and all these villains and their young proteges, and it just blew me away.
Now, did you continue on with the book?
Oh, yeah. You know, and, you know, it was funny. I was walking home with it, and there was a younger kid on my block, and he was just really being envious of me. And I said, you know, well, yeah, this is the number one issue. You better get your hands on a copy. But he was just too young to walk or bike there to the 7-Eleven. So his mom asked me to go back to get him a comic and then get one for yourself. And I picked up an extra issue while I was there. And, yeah, so I just stayed with it. Yeah, I just stayed with it throughout the course's run. You know, I kind of was at a little age when I was reaching adolescence where, you know, some of the material was – I stuck with it. I wanted to keep my string alive, but this was a title that had some ups and downs, but overall I thought it was a very, very worthwhile series.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, you would have been, by the time the series ended, you would have been just entering teenagerdom. You would have been a little like, maybe a little too old for this, but it's still the Super Friends.
Exactly.
All right. Well, very cool. Like I said, we're here to talk about the fourth issue, which, as I mentioned, is Riddles and Rockets by Birdwell, Fraiden, Bob Smith, and Danny O'Neill. It was on sale January 20th, 1977. The cover, we have this cover of a guy who we don't well, it says Skyrocket is clobbering the Super Friends, and it's this guy, and he's on the sort of Flash Gordon-y looking type dude with flames shooting out of his jet boots, and he is making quite a lot of hay out of the Super Friends. He's punching Wonder Woman and Superman and Batman and Robin, with Wendy and Marvin and Wonder Dog standing off to the side. And then there's this little inset, and it says, look who else is causing the Super Friends trouble. And then there's a little Murphy Anderson drawing of the Riddler, the classic Murphy Anderson stock art. And the fact that this is not drawn by Ramona Fraiden suggests to me that that was a last-minute addition, because, good Lord, obviously Ramona Freed could have drawn the Riddler on the cover. So I feel like maybe at the last minute they decided to throw him on there, because why else would you just glom on this stock art on top of this cover?
Yeah, Rob, I think it's a great cover. It's a new villain that looks formidable, right? At least on the right cover. I think it's a great use of space, too, and I really love the way Marvin and Wendy's eyes are looking up, you know, and I love the light blue background. And like you, I recognize the cropped image of the Riddler on the cover. And yeah, I think those were from promotional pinups that came around from 1966. They did one of the Joker, and I think the Penguin did one, and you had Carmine Infantino and Murphy Anderson put that together, and I thought it was really good. And kids, don't try to make your mouth look like the Riddler on the cover. It will hurt, and you don't want your mouth to get stuck that way.
I'm a little perturbed, as usual, that Aquaman is not on the cover, but they'll address that actually in a moment in this story. So, but yeah, it's not a bad cover, kid. You're wondering, who the hell is the Skyrocket guy?
My initial thought was, when you asked me about this story, was, wait, Aquaman doesn't appear a lot in this issue, does he? Oh, no, poor Rob. But I guess we'll get to more about that later.
Yeah, that is something I always liked about the Super Friends. Again, we'll get to that in a second about that. E. Nelson Birdwell treated everybody fairly. So, it's a nice cover. Like I said, the book came out on January 20th, 1977. So here is the story. In Gotham City, Batman and Robin catch an unfamiliar supervillain trying to rob a jewelry store. The crook emits some sort of heat beams from his hands and then activates the rocket pack on his back and flies out a window. He tells the Caped Crusaders his name is Skyrocket and escapes. Back at the Hall of Justice, Batman and Robin tell the other super friends, save Aquaman, about this new crook they've just encountered. Superman offers to help, but Batman says he and Robin are able to handle it. Then the trouble alert goes off, but instead of the police, it's the Riddler, who is managed to cut into the circuit. He offers one of his trademark glues to Batman. When does a wonder dog cause his master the most worry? Robin deduces it's when the master wonders where the dog is. And Superman mentions there's an ongoing museum display of original sheet music of Der Dietrich's Dog. When Marvin says he doesn't know that song, the Man of Steel even sings a few bars. Superman and Wonder Woman head to the Museum of Music, where waiting for them is not the Riddler, but Skyrocket. Skyrocket's array of powers are so dazzling that he escapes yet again. Meanwhile, Batman and Robin get a message from Commissioner Gordon about the Riddler, who has been spotted at the West Side Kennels. They interrupt the Riddler's attempt at dog napping, but he too manages to escape. Back at the Hall of Justice, the Supervillains commiserate, and Batman is confounded that the Riddler's clue seemed more for Skyrocket than his own plan of dog napping. Just then, he appears again, offering another riddle involving Wendy. Robin solves it, suggesting two different solutions, one of which is that the Riddler will strike at a rock concert that night. Wonder Woman, Robin, Wendy, and Marvin attend the concert of hit singer Jeanine Gale, who sings her hit song Midnight in the Andes. In the middle of the tune, Skyrocket appears, grabs a guitar, and uses it to collect valuables he then steals from the crowd. Despite their best efforts, Skyrocket escapes again. Meanwhile, Superman and Batman attend a performance of Romeo and Juliet and are there when the Riddler arrives. This time, he and his goons are captured, and at police headquarters, Riddler tells the world's finest duo that he stumbled over Skyrocket's plans to rob Gotham. Looking at Skyrocket as a rival, he dispensed clues that would hope put the Super Friends on his trail. But being compulsive about his own crimes, he couldn't stop himself from giving tips to his own nefarious schemes. One last riddle tips the Super Friends that Skyrocket and his next score involves the game of Monopoly, specifically a ship named the Ventnor, docked on the Atlantic Ocean at the Gotham waterfront. Skyrocket does arrive, with Superman there to stop him. Skyrocket flashes some light beams at the Man of Steel, causing him to flee in panic. Huh? Chasing Superman out to sea, Skyrocket is brought down by a pod of whales, commanded, of course, by Aquaman, who catches the plummeting crook after the water knocks out his backpack. Back at the Hall of Justice, all the Super Friends reflect on a job well done, and Marvin remarks that the Riddler and Skyrocket have one more thing related to Monopoly. They're both going to jail. All right. So, Chris, what did you think of this story?
Well, great job with the story recap, Rob. You know, I don't think
they're
this
so
was...
long. They're yes. so long. These stories are so dense. I feel so bad that I talked for so long. But I can't. E. Nelson Birdwell packs so much into 17 pages. It's ridiculous.
Yes. Yes. In my notes, I had, you know, I don't think this was as good as of a story as the previous three issues. But by no, it was still a great read. You know, I'm glad the story had two villains. And I remember reading this as a kid. If it was just the Riddler, I'd feel bad. It's like, you know, hey, Batman and Robin, you know, settle the guy's hash. You know, you don't need us to take care of him. Come on, Batman, can you handle your own villain? I thought that was really cool. One of the things, looking back on it, I have to wonder if E. Nelson Bridwell had some pop music on the brain when he wrote this, because you got this first appearance of Jeanine Gale, who's going to show up very soon, and again in about 10 issues down the road too, and she's singing this song, which is like based on this Maria Moldauer 1974 hit song, Midnight at the Oasis.
Midnight at the Oasis,
exactly.
Yeah,
you know, yep. Put your camel to bed, da da da. And the line here is, I had to go to sleep. And you got this villain called Skyrocket, and you see him in flight, and I'm thinking, okay, Skyrocket in flight. Oh, wait a minute, Afternoon Delight by Starland.
Oh my God, I never even thought of that.
You know, which was like a previous number one song from the previous year, you know, and you had both these songs, you know, just as a side note, they kind of had a little bit of sexual innuendo, you know, mm-hmm, they were kind of exploiting mm-hmm. it, you know, but, you know, I thought everybody had their moments to shine. Ramona Freyden's artwork is good. I think we'll talk a little bit about later. You had Robin solving all the three riddles. And I thought, you know, that how cool is that? You know, the Team Wonder holding his own. Rob, like you, I thought Skyrocket sort of looked like this villain from a Flash Gordon serial with the fins yep. on his costumes and rockets. And
it's got like a Ming the Merciless face.
Yes.
With a Flash Gordon.
Yes. Episode. And the story itself felt like it almost could take place in the 30s, 40s, or 50s. You know, there was really no, aside from the music itself, there was really no something to stamp it with the time there. But I thought it was an enjoyable read, and Freyden's artwork is really, really good. And hey, I learned something about, you know, the composer Septimus Winter, and a group of whales can be called a gam. Who says comics aren't educational?
Exactly. I'm glad you mentioned the song, The Midnight at the Oasis, because, yeah, that's Midnight Maria Moldauer. It was released in February of 1974. It peaked at number 6 on the Billboard charts, but it was absolutely still on rotation on FM radio, because I remember one of my other shows is Mountain Comics.
Yeah.
That was a song that played all the time on the radio, well into the 70s. So, I mean, even though the song peaked long before the Super Friends ever started, it was definitely still in rotation. So clearly, yeah, E. Nelson Bridwell had that on the brain. When I got to the story again, and I was like, Midnight at the what? I was like, oh, okay, yeah, he's clearly. And I also love in the detail that, like, the Super Friends regard rock music as this foreign thing. They're just like, that's the kind of music you're into, right, Wendy and Marvin? It's like they're just like, Superman listens to jazz or something, or they're all just all these old fuddy-duddies that are just like, oh, this lewd rocking and rolling that you kids are into. It's like, okay, all right, Super Friends. So yeah, I love that. I love that little detail going to the concert. So the splash page, the opening splash page, where you've got Skyrocket flying through, and it's basically reproducing the cover where he's knocking out the four Super Friends, and then you get the little panel where it says Aquaman will be along later in the story. And I said this is something I'll be repeating throughout the series, is that I love that E. Nelson Bridwell really did regard these five characters as equal. I mean, maybe Robin was a half step sort of, but I like that it wasn't, he didn't regard Aquaman as like a backup or like, it was like, no, hey, the Super Friends are these five characters. And if one is missing, I need to point out why he's missing. I always liked that. And of course, Aquaman being the character typically the most used to being relegated to the sidelines, I just like that even on the splash page, he's pointing out the kids, don't worry, Aquaman will be along later. I love that detail.
Awesome.
So I get the opening sequence is really fun in the jewelry store where, I mean, Skyrocket's powers, they seem to be kind of a little indistinct, because in the opening scene with Batman and Robin, he's shooting heat rays out of his hands. It's not like his costume is the thing that's doing the stuff. So I'm not really – like, he's got bare hands and he's blasting Batman and Robin with his hands. So it's like, well, does he have superpowers? I never got a read on whether he had the powers or the suit, but it seems to suggest that he has powers aside from the suit.
I like the suggestion that there's some formability, because when Superman and Wonder Woman are after him, I'm thinking, oh, well, the issue is going to be over. I wonder what they're going to do with the second half of the book. But he basically holds them off. He holds his own for a moment there. And you kind of think, well, couldn't Superman do this? But no, you have to kind of continue the story along. And I went with it.
Yeah. I do like that moment, and you referred to it, but the thing with Riddler, but back at the Hall of Justice where Superman's like, do you need help with this guy? Batman's like, no, we'll take on Plainfield. We can handle this ourselves. Like, there's a little bit of like, you know, turf building there, or turf war there. Like, I'll handle this. I don't need you involved, Superman. Come on. I love Superman singing the song. That is just like, whoa, all of a sudden he just breaks into a tune. Like, that's something I don't know. I think a lot of writers would have been comfortable with that version of Superman doing, but I like that he just is, and he puts his hand on his chest like he's doing like, he's a classic opera singer.
Yes.
It's a very corny sequence, of course, beautifully rendered by Ramona Freed.
Well, yeah, and Rob, I love Ramona Freed's artwork. You know, she was doing Plastic Man, as previously stated around that. Yep. And a side note, it was so easy for me to talk my dad into buying that title for me as a kid, since he read Plastic Man when he was a boy. And
oh, wow.
Just the art on both of these titles was just marvelous back then. And I really like her renderings of Robin and Wonder Woman. Robin looks like an adult, yet he doesn't look silly in his costume. And Wonder Woman looks like an average thin woman who just happens to do things that a superhero can do. And rereading these, I forgot about the rounded panels, presumably to make it look like a TV screen. And, you know, I just like the scenes when Wonder Woman's deflecting the fireballs with her bracelets. You had Superman flying after Skyrocket in this rear point of view shot. And just the way just she does a matter-of-fact scene where you see these concert goers just enamored with Jeannie Gale singing. You know, just they're totally mesmerized by this. And just to see the majesticness of the Gamma of Whales leaping in the air, boy, she could do it all.
Yeah, she could. I mean, it was – I liked actually Rick Estrada's work in the first two issues, although inked by Vince Coletta didn't do him any favors as usual. But I've seen Rick Estrada in other stuff, and I really liked it. But, yeah, Ramona Freyden is – that's the big draw here, is that it's Ramona Freyden drawing all these great characters. I like in the sequence where Batman and Robin stop Riddler from the dog napping. There's a couple of great little moments here. I like when Robin says – right, Riddler, but if you're so smart, why are you still a crook? And, of course, to people that love the Batman the Animated Series and who doesn't, that sounds awfully familiar because, of course, there was an episode, season one, episode 41, about starring the Riddler, and it's called If You're So Smart, Why Aren't You Rich? And I was like, is that a nod to the Super Friends panel? But I went and did some research, and I saw that If You're So Smart, Why Aren't You Rich? Was a phrase in the culture, in American culture from like the 20s, the 30s, and the 40s. So it was something that Nee Nelson Bridwell would have known. And then in this panel, he's doing a riff on it by saying, if you're so smart, why are you still a crook? So when the Batman the Animated Series used it again, they were just borrowing it from the culture. I don't think necessarily they were taking it from this panel. But boy, that line jumped out of me when I saw it. I was like, wait, that was an episode of BTAS. whoa, hold on.
Well, speaking of lines that Robin said that just really jumped out at me too, was like the one where Robin has this encounter with a Skyrocket, and he's swinging on a rope after he lasts him, and then he's falling, and Wonder Woman's there to catch him. And
yes.
Robin says, well, I've fallen on harder and less attractive things.
Like, wow, Robin. Okay. Everybody flirts with Wonder Woman. She's just used to it at this point. Just like, okay. Yeah, I had that in my notes too. I was like, wow, okay. He's kind of flirting, and he's like, all right. I do love Ramona Freyden, the little details she throws in. After they foil Riddler's dog napping, all the dogs are left behind. They run out of the van. And you see that as Batman is watching the Riddler take away, the dogs are, like, licking Robin's face.
Oh, yeah.
And he's leaning over to, like, kind of pet them, which I just think is great. Again, it's like that's extra effort. You know,
yes.
I mean, she didn't have to do that. It could have been a very standard shot of them just watching the Riddler van get away. But I love that little detail. I just think that's really sweet.
Oh, good catch.
So I love all that stuff. So, yeah, the shot at the concert is great. The rapturous fans. I like that Nelson Bridwell is, you know, goofing. It's like, I walked through the Andes at midnight. My llama had gone to sleep. Snowy peaks at the equator like a refrigerator. And then the song stops. I don't think that Skyrocket's plan, though, to steal valuables from the crowd is like, how much money could he possibly get?
Yes.
I mean, are people really? He steals a pearl necklace off of a red-haired girl in the crowd, but I mean, really, at a rock concert, is there that many valuables to steal? That didn't seem like a dubious plan at best.
Indeed, it sounded something a little bit kind of from the 40s, if you will. But as a kid, I went with it. You know, you just couldn't help it. But boy, you know, just I just don't know if this guy's going to last. You know, for a fun issue, it worked.
Yeah. When Superman and Batman apprehend Riddler, there's a couple of sequences of it's a reminder of how differently the standard was for the comic book and the cartoon, because we know famously the cartoon, the superheroes could not punch anybody. They had to always like wrap them in metal or put them in a cage, but they couldn't actually strike anyone. But here, Batman punches Riddler right in the gut. And it actually looks like he's like, here's the answer to the riddle. The end comes in the middle. And he punches Riddler, and you see Riddler like, ugh! And then Superman punches four crooks out in one shot. So, you know, they could actually dispense a little bit of violence in the comic book as opposed to the cartoon, where they were never allowed to do any of that stuff. So then later on, when they Skyrocket goes out to sea. Now, this is another moment where I really appreciate E. Nelson Bridwell working hard to fit Aquaman in, because there's no reason to do this. They could have just – Superman could have just apprehended Skyrocket, but he drags Skyrocket out to sea just so Aquaman can douse him with the whales. There's really no need to do that, but it's – Ian B. wanted to include Aquaman in the proceedings, which I appreciate. And I love that Skyrocket thinks that he's actually got the drop on Superman. He actually says out loud, oh, this is sweet. Imagine, I've got Superman himself on the run. He's like way over his skis there, Skyrocket.
Yeah. But, you know, and he just conveniently knows, and Aquaman knows exactly where to be at the precise moment to
yes, save the he's day. Under the sea, right, and he catches him.
Yeah.
And Skyrocket goes, gulp, it's Aquaman. Aquaman literally only makes two panels in this entire book, but I still appreciate it because, again, I always love the use of the Finny Friends. I think that's dramatic, so it's just very funny to me. But, I mean, the Super Friends did not need to do this to Skyrocket. I mean, he's already there. He's at the ship on the dock, so why not? But it was just sort of funny that, you know, they really could have just done this themselves. But, you know, Aquaman gets to be the hero, and then he appears at the end at the Hall of Justice, and then we end with a nice little gag about the Monopoly board, and it's just, you know, you can hear that music, the sort of Super Friends music. I love also, too, the detail of Batman just sitting on the table, like, as opposed to sitting on a chair. He's, and that wraps up the case, and he says, Batman, get your butt off the counter. What are you doing? It's in the Hall of Justice.
Very, very casual, yes. I like that
rendering. Yeah, absolutely. Now, this issue features the first letters page of the series. This is when they finally got letters in, and because previously the first three issues were all just text pieces by Ian B. So the letters are pretty positive, except for a letter from Mr. Al Schroeder from Nashville, Tennessee, who says, Dear Joe, writing to Joe Orlando, the editor, I take typewriter in hand to complain about a magazine that you have inflicted on the public called Super Friends. In general, I am in favor of these DVTV, he means to say DC. The changes in Shazam vastly improved the mag. Isis, too, is well adapted in comic form. But Super Friends, I can only hope, with the recent demise of the Saturday morning show, that this magazine will meet the demise it deserves. Ooh, it is hard to believe that this is Rick Estrada, Vince Coletta, and you, Joe Orlando, as artists. Granted, you were trying to match the TV show. I do not accept that. The comic medium does not suffer from the problems of animation, so the general art book level is higher. I do not want Wendy, Marvin, and Wonder Dog, if they must be included, drawn on such a simplistic level. Nor do I want dialogue from E. Nelson Bridwell, like a scientist exclaiming, great photons, or Aquaman exclaiming, Neptune's nautical knowledge. Nor did the appearance of Toyman have any continuity with its current appearance in Superman. Oh, it was not totally horrible. The explanation of Wendy and Marvin's identities was nice, but it should have been in the story. And I can't take seriously the idea of supervillain kid sidekicks. Okay, you'll answer, but this magazine is obviously made for younger readers. I assure you that I would have hated it at 8 years of age. Unless this mag is revamped totally, I will watch it fall without a tear.
Ouch!
I am sure Mr. Schroeder is on Twitter, because that seems to be the kind of mentality we have over on Twitter. Wow, man, Al Schroeder did not like this book.
No, he doesn't, you know, and, you know, props to Ian B. for just printing the letter.
Printing it, yeah,
you know,
yeah, just, yeah.
You know, he can't, you know, not going to please everybody, and he printed it and responded, so good for him.
Yeah, that is, whew, I mean, it's sort of funny, this idea that, and it's always been with us. Which is sort of simultaneously sad, and then, you know, you kind of say, well, we've always had this attitude. But the idea that you've inflicted this on the public, well, just don't buy it.
Yeah.
Like, just don't buy it, Al. Like, you don't have to buy the comic. I don't understand. But, boy, does he hit. Luckily, all the other letters are much more positive. But, boy, Al Schroeder. Now I want to track this throughout the issues to see if Al Schroeder writes back whether the book changes in his mind or did he just drop it after the first three issues or something. But, boy, he is – he is not a fan of this comic book.
No, not
but,
at
yeah,
all.
Like you said, Ian B., good for printing it. At the very bottom of the letters page, it mentions the Direct Current's hotline, which you could call a 1-800 number and find out the current news about DC Comics. Now, this Direct Current's hotline had kind of disappeared by the time I would have been old enough to kind of like pay attention to this. Did you ever call this number, Chris?
I did a few weeks.
You did?
Yes, absolutely.
I had no idea Chris was going to say that. We did not plan this ahead of time. That's awesome. That's awesome that you called them.
Sure. I had asked my parents' permission, and I got through. And a lot of times the line was busy. And I think when the number first came out, you only had a certain window of the evening to call in, and it was Eastern time and I was living in Central. So I had to kind of had to do the math of when to call. And basically it was like a condensed version of like, you know, the Daily Planet you see over there. You talk about the stories and what was coming out. And Rob, the only memory I have of it was on one particular call, and it was a recording. You hear people, different people from the staff talking about what was coming out. But I remember one in particular, Carmine Infantino had the recording, and he basically talked about everything. And at the very end of the recording, he said something to the effect of, "And watch out for DC's new hero, Black Lightning." And I go, "Ooh, I wonder what that's all about." And that's my only recollection was Carmine Infantino telling the listeners to be on the lookout for a new superhero called Black Lightning coming out.
Very cool. How long was the call? How long was the recording? Like 30 seconds or something?
I want to say it was about 2 to 3 minutes.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
That's okay.
Yeah.
That's not bad.
Not too bad.
That's really I wish I had been old enough to sort of call it. That would have been really cool to hear that.
Oh yeah, it was a lot of fun, you know. And there was something really kind of big shoddy about it, you know, being in the loop with fandom. And it was such a treat. And I was sorry to see it go.
Oh, that's very cool. Oh, that's awesome. That's great. Well, let's talk about the couple of things I like to sections I like to go through in the individual issues. First up is the best friend, as I call it. And in your opinion, Chris, which hero of all the super friends, and now we have opened this up to Wendy, Marvin, and Wonder Dog, thanks to my previous guests that have included them. Which hero do you think fared the best in this story?
Well, you know, pound for pound, Aquaman did the most with the least amount to do, you know, so you have to give it him. But I have to give an honorable mention to Robin, for he was 3 for 3 in the role department. And it was like, there was no, like, musing. There was no rubbing of the chins. It was like, snap, got it. Let me walk you through it. And he solved all 3 riddles, you know. And how cool was that to see the teen wonder actually have a little bit of a moment to shine there? How about you?
Yeah, I agree with you. I originally wrote Aquaman, but you're right. Robin solves all the riddles. He gets that nice little flirtation with Wonder Woman and doesn't get his head knocked off, which is good. And I like the moment where the dog's looking in his face. So he kind of does drive of all the heroes, kind of drives the story the most, which is nice. Again, it's nice that the ENB spreads it around. So the other question I have is the villain roundup. There's only one new villain here, which is, of course, Skyrocket. Do you think that Skyrocket really had much juice to maybe go on to a bigger career, or is he better relegated to a kind of a one-off ENB creation?
Sadly, the latter, and I don't mean any disrespect. He worked for the story, but I think that's as far as it could go, and I don't think we ever see him again.
Yeah, we're in agreement on this. There isn't much to him. Other than the heat ray that he blasted Batman and Robin, he really just has mostly a light show. He's kind of Dazzler in a sort of way. He just sort of like blinds you with the lights and then he takes off. You're like, well, all right. So yeah, there's not a whole lot here. I do, like I said, his sort of Ming the Merciless, Snidely Whiplash face. The design is okay. The purple and blue suit. He has this sort of symbol on his chest, which looks vaguely sort of Rocket-like. But yeah, he's kind of fine. It's not somebody that needed a Who's Who listing, for instance. So yeah, he's probably just a good one and done kind of character. And speaking of one and done, this story, much like the previous issue, was reprinted in the Best of DC Digest #3, which I covered with Sean Myers. And I guess I'm assuming that it was reprinted because it was a one-off. Very very soon, ENB would start doing continued stories, and those are harder to reprint. So that's probably why in the digest they reprinted #3 and #4 back to back, because these were both one-off stories. There's nothing else. This is just a nice, simple story with the Riddler and this new guy, and again, Skyrocket will never be seen again. So, but all in all, a very satisfying issue, though.
Indeed. And this issue also marked a couple of lasts for the title. This is going to be the last one with a 30-cent cover price, and this is going to be the last appearance of this incarnation of the DC TV logo with this particular cover.
Oh, I love that thing.
Yeah.
Sorry to see it go.
Yeah. And yeah. Boy, when that price bump, I didn't know what I was going to do with my allowance. After that, you know,
that was a big deal back then.
Oh, yeah.
My
allowance was kind of incremental. What 2 comic books would be the my allowance. And then, you know, now I got to ask my dad for 70 cents. Oh, no, what's going to happen? How's this going to work? And when I saw the 35, my soul just crushed. But when I saw the next issue in that cover, I just had to have it. And one more thing, you know, like Chris Franklin, I never really was much of a Marvin fan, but I think he comes off better in the comics than the series, from what I recall.
Well, he doesn't have that voice.
Yes.
Frank Welker. I'm butchering it, but yeah, his voice is very annoying in the cartoon. There's no doubt.
And I never bought his appearance, you know, because he never seemed to be, quote, all in as a, quote, costume hero. I mean, he's just wearing a cape, you know, and it's like, just can't take him seriously, you know, and you know, when I heard that the names of the characters were going to be Wendy and Marvin, it just made me instantly think of the Harvey Comics characters. You had Wendy, the Good Little Witch, and you had a character called Marvin who was a pal of Little Audrey. So I'm wondering, you know, when I heard those names, that when this was announced, I didn't know if there was going to be like a tie-in or crossover. No. They're individual characters. And as you previously mentioned on past podcast, Rob, props to E. Nelson Bridwell for actually giving these characters some nice background in those text pieces in those early issues.
Yeah. One little detail that I don't think I've mentioned to this point. I think I've mentioned it on other shows related to the Super Friends, and I mentioned it on the feedback page on the website, FineWaterPodcast.com. But one of my favorite data points about the Super Friends was something I learned in an issue of Tomorrow's back issue many years ago, where they did two whole issues devoted to Charlton Comics. And one of the editors, I think, mentioned that because Charlton had a licensing deal with Hanna-Barbera, there was an actual window where they could have produced a Super Friends comic.
Whoa.
Yes. And apparently this was the sort of thing where Charlton noticed it and then apparently were like, whoa, wait a minute, could we really do this? And as they looked into it, DC got wind of it and went to Hanna-Barbera and clamped down on that, and there went that idea. But there was a window where Charlton literally could have done a Super Friends comic book. And man, I would have killed for that to have happened. Could you imagine what it would have looked like to even have done one issue featuring Superman, Batman done by another company?
Unbelievable.
I mean, I can't imagine what that would have looked like.
Unbelievable.
Yeah. I read that in an issue of back issue and my eyes bugged out of my head like, what? You know, and I remembered, I think it was Chris Franklin. We both discovered it independent of each other. And then we were talking once and he was like, hey, you know, I read an Invec issue once and I knew where he was going. I was like, yeah, exactly. I couldn't believe that happened. Could you imagine a Super Friends comic with a Charlton bullet on the left-hand corner? That would have been just amazing. But alas, it never quite happened. So yeah. I'll never get tired of pointing that out.
Oh. Rob, what'd you think of Janine Gale? Because I know we're going to see her pretty soon. And I don't know, you know, it almost like she had a little bit of a showcase and had more to do than a supporting character normally would.
He does give her a good amount of space. You know, I mean, just the fact that she gets like 2-3 pages and it gets the concert and stuff like that. But I thought it was cute. It grounds the super. I mean, with the mention of Monopoly, it grounds them in. I always like it when characters in fiction take in movies or TV that really exist. For some reason, a lot of writers are always, for some reason, gun-shy. But I like it when, you know, like when on Friends, I used to watch Friends, they would talk about movies they would go see. And they were like, we're going to go see You've Got Mail. I'm like, oh, that's a real movie.
Yeah.
So, I mean, obviously, Jeanine Gale isn't real. She's a stand-in for Maria Muldaur. But I like that there are rock concerts in the Super Friends universe. And there's Monopoly. These are things that you recognize. So I liked all that.
Great call.
Yeah, that's cool stuff. So that is going to do it for this issue of the Super Friends. So, Chris, thank you so much for stopping by. I really appreciate it.
Well, thanks so much, Rob. I had a blast. And just to remind the listeners, I can be heard every week on the Professor Frenzy Show, where my friend Jerry and I talk about new independent comics. And we read the previous week, and then we talk about the new releases that we're looking forward to. New episodes drop every Wednesday. It's available on Apple, Spotify, wherever you get your podcasts. We also have content such as Memory Minute Monday and Professor Frenzy's Bedtime Stories, which drop every week. Now, I also have a segment called Chris's Cornucopia of Curiosities on the Backworld Oracle podcast, hosted by the talented Stella, and that's where I look at the 90s Batman Adventures comic book title based on the animated series of the same name. And I also have Nightwatch, a segment within a segment where I look at the current issue of Nightwing and look at it from a shipper's perspective, and new episodes drop every month. Rob, thanks so much for having me on.
All right, well done, man. You got those promos down. That's very like a professional. All right, everybody. Well, stay tuned. We are going to play a podcast promo from a show that Chris just mentioned. And then when we come back, Chris Franklin is going to join me again for another segment of For All Merch Kind. Stay tuned.
Stuff we review, a little old, a lot of new. Come and join in all the fun, help clean up when we're done. Come party with the professor. Come party with the professor. Professor Frenzy Show. Professor Frenzy Show. Professor Frenzy Show. The Professor Frenzy Show. If you like indie comics and also like podcasts, please try the Professor Frenzy Show. Find the show in iTunes search and Facebook. Episodes tweeted out on at Professor Frenzy on Twitter. Thank you.
And welcome back, everybody. We're here with Chris Franklin for another segment of For All Merch Kind. Hi, Chris.
Hello, everyone.
People really loved our first installment of For All Merch Kind, and I knew they would because, A, it's as us talking about Super Friends merchandise, and it's you. Everyone loves hearing you on any of the podcasts, so I'm very happy that you're back for this second installment of For All Merch Kind.
Oh, it's great to be back. And I think we should cue the Jethro Tull for this one.
I think so. Yeah, I mean, the first installment, Chris and I talked about the Super Friends bedsheet set, which in his case is still in use, which is amazing. but yeah, here I decided for this second installment, we're going to talk about something a little more on the mercenary scale, I would say, of merchandising. And what I mean by that is this was an item that clearly a manufacturer had lying around and they wanted to move them. And they were like, we can just slap a card on this and we'll call it a Super Friends blank and we'll move a couple. And in this case, and you'll see the picture over on the website, finewaterpodcast.com, in the gallery post, Super Friends rubber swim mask fins and snorkel set. And basically what this is, it is just a blue snorkel and fin and you know, rubber, just made, you know, like typical snorkel and fin set that you would get to go, you know, scuba diving or floating in the water, not scuba diving, but going, you know, floating in the water or whatever. And they just slapped a Super Friends card on it because some licensor realized, wait a minute, isn't Aquaman in the Super Friends? Perfect. So you have the Super Friends logo, which has been amended to take Aquaman off of it, which hurts me deep in my soul. Because there's lots of merchandise that Aquaman – for some reason they took Aquaman off of the – I mean, think about that, Chris. They actually had to make the effort to erase him. Why? Why would you do that?
I don't know. Maybe DC had – you know, they had different versions on the same sheet that they could use, and they had a version with Aquaman and one without, and I don't know. But, yeah, and the logo is clearly the actual animation, like, yeah, from the show. Yeah. I mean, this isn't just the Alex Toth artwork from the comic or, you know, this is actual, looks like a cell from the cartoon. So
yeah. Boggles the mind why you would remove Aquaman, other than the fact, I guess, that he's repeated here, because down at the bottom under where it says rubber swim mask, fins and snorkel, there is this little wave kind of graphic where it's these little scalloped blue things to sort of look like waves. And then you see, underneath that is the classic Murphy Anderson stock art Aquaman pose where he's swimming. He's, you know, turning into like a U-shape kind of thing. And maybe they figured that since we have him here down on the card at the bottom, we shouldn't put him on the logo. I'm baffled as to why you would do it. But it's so clear that this was some manufacturer was like, we have all these snorkel sets and we're not moving them. Maybe kids will buy them if we slap the Super Friends name on them. And there you go. Done.
Right. I mean, they didn't even bother to cast it in, like, orange and green,
yellow. No, they're blue, right.
It's blue. So if it's going to clash with your Aquaman uniform, if you've got your Underoos Aquaman t-shirt on and wear this, it's going to clash. You know, it's not going to look good. So, yeah, this, you're right. Mercenary is a good word for this because – I mean, we know that, you know, and our buddy Brian Hyler is the master of rack toys. He wrote a book on it.
Oh, yeah.
And a great book on it. And we know that rack toy manufacturers love to just, you know, take a license and just slap it on like a cap gun or whatever. I mean, Spider-Man had a, you know, set called the Exterminator or something like that. It's like, really? And it had nothing to do with Spider-Man. But I think this is – usually they at least put a sticker – of the character on there, you know, or it's at least cast in the right colors.
Yep,
and but yeah, this one is just a total product was laying around. The most effort they put in was getting a license and printing this card. And it's I noticed online, looking for this online, there's the same manufacturer, which I can't read who this,
I can't make it out. Yeah.
And I looked on, they pieced this set out as well and had, other, modifications of the mask came separately, and the snorkel and the mask came without the fins, and so there's different iterations of a similar products, and they've all got that same logo, no Aquaman up top standing on top of the word Super Friends, and also the Murphy Anderson U-shaped Aquaman swimming pose at the bottom, you know, around the product. And so they made, as you would say, they made a meal out of this. They put that license to good use. I guess they thought we can move a lot of merchandise with just slapping Aquaman and Super Friends on this.
Yeah. I mean, you know, I never had these things. Obviously, I never even saw them. I didn't spend a lot of time swimming as a kid, really. And so I wouldn't have even been in the market for this kind of thing anyway. But yeah, it's really amazing that it's clearly they were sitting off in a warehouse. There was nothing special about them because they're cast in this kind of very dark purpley blue, and they were just like, oh, you know what? We have there's no Submariner license to get. Super Friends is out, so let's just put Aquaman on. And if I want to be as charitable as possible, like, I actually am. I don't want to say impressed. That's too much of a word. But, like, they did make the effort to get, like, the Aquaman stock art and make it. I mean, they literally could have just called this Super Friends rubber swim mask, fins and snorkel, and just used the original Super Friends logo with Aquaman in the background. But they actually did take the effort to, like, find some watery kind of graphics and get that Aquaman stock art from DC Comics and put him on there. Like, that did take, like, an extra 10 minutes of effort as opposed to just putting the Super Friends logo on it.
Right, right. I mean, yeah, it's a nice looking little package. I mean, yeah. it would look good in a Super Friends collection for sure. It's yep. just it's just funny that the product itself, the card art's fine. It's just the product itself looks absolutely nothing like it comes from Super Friends or Aquaman.
Yeah, nothing special at all. Nothing special at all. I've seen this. So he said that's going to do it for this segment for all merch kind. Sometimes they're going to be longer. Sometimes they're going to be shorter. I sort of like the idea that after doing the first one of the sheet set, which was kind of like a genuine product that they put some care into, that we then kind of go and just pick something a little on the really cheap side, which is definitely this thing. So Chris, thank you again for joining me for All Merch Kind. I really enjoyed doing these segments. For thank you for coming back.
Oh yeah, no problem. I'll be here every time. I love talking about this stuff.
Absolutely. So all right, thanks everybody for listening. I want you to stay tuned, and when I come back, we are going to do listener feedback.
Light Bright, the toy that lets you create beautiful pictures with light.
Light Bright, making things with light.
Work with colorful pegs that glow with light, light bulb not included. Make people, animals, things, and with refills, Bugs Bunny or Bozo the Clown.
Light Bright, making things with light.
You can make lots of pretty pictures with Light Bright from Hasbro.
And we're back with the part of the show I call Super Fans, and that is where I read the feedback from the previous episode of For All Mankind. And these are the comments that are going to come from our website, fireandwaterpodcast.com. But before I get to that, we have a new iTunes review. So exciting. I love iTunes reviews. First up is 5 stars from Gold Dragon. It says, a super friendly podcast. I was a huge fan of the Super Friends. Growing up, I had watched nearly every episode of the cartoon, but only read one issue of the comic. Now I'm finally getting a chance to experience a series I barely knew existed. Rob does a great job covering each issue, and the behind-the-scenes information on certain issues makes for a fascinating listening experience. As a longtime fan of later incarnations of the Justice League, I'm happy to find that some of my favorite members actually made their debut in this series. Looking forward to following along with each new episode. Thank you so much, Gold Dragon. I really appreciate it. And of course, you can go to Apple Podcasts and leave us an iTunes review. That would really, really help get the show noticed, because as I mentioned, there are other media out there called For All Mankind. And so if you just plug that in, you get a lot of different stuff. I really would appreciate an iTunes review. It helps get the show noticed. So thank you so much, Gold Dragon. So as I said, let's move on to the comments from the website, fireandwaterpodcast.com. And these are the comments for the previous issue, which were Super Friends number 3, which I did with Michael Bailey. First up, Ito Boznar says, another great show all around. Enjoy the conversation in both segments. On the topic of merchandise, I have to say that I'm impressed with the fact that Chris not only still has things like those bedsheets, but they were still in continuous use. Any stuff like that I had, like Star Wars bedsheets and Aquaman pajamas, disappeared before I hit my teens. And, as per my comment for Digest Cast number 10, it's nice to hear that Michael shares my view that some of these throwaway villains could and should have been used elsewhere. Thank you so much, Adar. Yeah, I was impressed too that Chris's Super Friends bedsheets are still in use 40 years later. Those are pretty durable sheets. Michael Bailey, of course, who was on that very episode, chimes in. He says, Ryan and Chris lamented over on Nightcast that they never branded the Max Allen Collins stories by Colin Collins the Notorious M.A.C. I think Rob needs to jump on the idea of calling E. Nelson Birdwell the Notorious E.N.B., not because there's anything wrong with Birdwell, but because of how awesome that man was. Seriously. If I had a Mount Rushmore of people that knew a lot of comics in general and Superman in specific, E.N.B. would not only be on there, I may put him there twice. By the way, I hope I'm not trying to make Fetch happen. And then he mentioned that Chris Franklin said, I wasn't one of those kids that liked the villains more than heroes, to which Michael says, translation, Chris wasn't Geoff Johns. Thank you very much, Michael. Mark Baker writes, as in an attempt to keep the basic sound of Notorious E.N.B., but perhaps a less ambiguously positive overtone, may I suggest the Miraculous E.N.B.? Hard to say, but not a bad idea. Thank you, Mark. Martin Gray from the Too Dangerous for a Girl blog says, do we know why they were called Super Friends? It sounds so sappy. Why not the Justice League of America? And since it was Super Friends, why are Zane and Jaina the Wonder Twins? It's illogical. Cindy would agree with me. I get why the fine pooch couldn't be Superdog, of course. Hey, I referenced the three-eyed Kryptonian babooch on my blog only last week. Points for me. The exclamation goes back to at least the Silver Age. What a fab story this was, and a great discussion, boys. E&B really did take advantage of the slacker rules in CCA books compared to TV having folk killed. I'd love to see some of these one-off guys revived in, say, the Wonder Twins book. Yeah, they're literally morts, but we never got to see what they actually could do. There's no shame in being captured by a guy who could create the cosmos as most powerful patchwork man. True that, Martin. There's probably some fun ideas there in some of those villains we only see for one or two panels. Michael Bailey chimes back in. And he says, the probably apocryphal story about why it was called Super Friends is that by 1973, things in America were getting pretty divisive. Oh, thank God that's over. Thanks to the Vietnam War. So it was decided to go with something more friendly sounding and less jingoistic. Martin Gray then replies, that's fascinating. Thank you. That's E&B level service. Doug Van Diver offers an alt theory. He says, maybe it went something like this. One, Hanna-Barbera gets the license to do DC animation. Two, someone at the studio has a really good idea to team up some heroes in one show. Three, they go off and develop from there. Nobody thinks to check whether there is a DC hero team already with their own name, headquarters, roster, etc. Four, at some point whilst developing the show, they are informed that Justice League of America is a thing. What's a Justice League? Some executive might say. This news might or might not be welcome. Not everyone likes to learn that their great idea has already been done. Five. So, having already done the work of coming up with a TV show title, cast of characters, Hall of Justice, and so forth, they also retrofit some references to JLA in scripts and such, while also doing their own show mostly as planned. That way, the development work isn't wasted, but they can also claim to be based on legit JLA comics. And then Chris Franklin then chimes into Doug's comment. He says, might be, Doug. I do know that Super Friends spun out of a desire to do Scooby-Doo meets the Superheroes show after the success of the Batman and Robin team-up episodes of the new Scooby-Doo movies. Hanna-Barbera pitched an idea that had Scooby and the gang teaming up with lots of other heroes, including Marvel ones. But cooler heads, and perhaps DC, prevailed to make this a DC-centric show and add in some Scooby-like kids in the form of the Junior Super Friends and Wonder Dog, of course. I did not know that I knew that they pitched that as a sort of Scooby-Doo meets the superheroes idea, and that sort of led to the Super Friends, but I didn't know that Marvel was even in the mix. That, oh my God, the mind reels at the thought of that. Scooby and the gang meets Shang-Chi, Master of Kung Fu. Martin Gray comes back in once again. He says, thanks, Doug. That's plausible. And thanks, Chris. You've just blown my mind. I wonder what would have happened had the Scooby-Doo team-ups with Mama Cass been the most popular. And then Chris Franklin commenting on the episode in general says, I think my mom's womb must have been something like the TARDIS or something. She only weighed 110 pounds when pregnant. Fun discussion, and it's so great to see Ramona Freyden arrive on the book. Her style was complementary to the animation, but unique in its own right. I associate her look for the characters with the brand almost as much as Toth's designs. And apologize for defaulting back to my childhood pronunciation of Mr. Toth's name in the Merch Kind segment, Old Habits Die Hard. No problem, Chris. Brian Linton says, thank you for another amazing episode, including the new segment. I'm right there with you that I can hear the voices from the cartoon show when I read through the image gallery posts. In regards to the one-off villains in this issue, I can't believe that Geoff Johns never revived Spectrum to tie him into the emotional Spectrum, a golden opportunity lost. And notice that, Brian. Looking forward to the next episode. Thank you. Dr. Ann says, great episode. The world beater definitely has a Frankenstein Jr. vibe to him. Perfect for Hanna-Barbera stuff. I like World Beater. I like Amazo. I like Mimic. But I am in the bag for the Super Adaptoid. Love that character. A babooch is sort of a Kryptonian baboon. Sterling Gates brought back the reference to into his Supergirl run a couple of times. I like Marvin and Wendy. I don't like the Wonder Twins. Glad the real Junior Super Friends get a chance to shine. Thank you, Ange. And yeah, he does. World Beater definitely does have a Frankenstein Junior 5 to him. Again, it's a darn shame he never got to appear in the cartoon. It would have been pretty cool to see in animation. Matt Saroy says, had this been an episode of the cartoon, the supervillains would have simply had their powers siphoned out of them and transferred into the World Beater. Then at the end, the Super Friends would have then returned the powers to those villains while teaching a lesson about taking things that aren't yours, then dumped them all in jail together. The last scene would show the angry villains surrounding the mad doctor who stole their powers, and he cringes and whines, no hard feelings, gentlemen. That's a great ending, Matt. I totally could picture that. I would have been, it would have been fantastic. As I said, it's too bad that World Beater never made it into the show. Captain Entropy says, great show, gents. I'll elaborate. Great guests. Thank you for introducing Michael Bailey to the Super Friends comic, and Chris's insights are always welcome. If you only could find some enthusiasm about these characters and their merchandise. Oh, well. Great story. I didn't have the issue, but I had the digest. I always appreciated the use of actual strategy, or at least a clever tactic. No polarity reversal, deus ex machina from Marvin and Wendy. Great sheets. I had the first set and loved them. Some of my friends had the Star Wars sheets, Rob. The set with the villains might have kept me up at night wondering if those scoundrels were getting royalties somehow. My one complaint, in retrospect, I'd wish they'd printed some peach coloring for the character's skin. I know that as a group, comic book superheroes were far too pasty white back in the 70s, but the albino look is carrying it a bit far. An unintentional commentary? Great bicentennial public service announcement. I plan to use practice what we pray in real life. Great sign-off and great decision, Rob. I, too, would have closed the auditions after Zoom's submission. I agree with your other nuclear subs. It's great to know we'll be keep hearing Zoom's voice despite the way it can trigger those darn eye-watering allergies. Going back, I love that bicentennial public service announcement. I couldn't believe when I found it on YouTube. It's just too perfect. I almost would want to use it every episode, except it would just get old and I want to use different things. But, man, I love that thing. And, Zoom got his submission in, I knew he was going to be first. And then, of course, after he left us, the decision was final and that he's going to be on the show in perpetuity. So thank you for appreciating my decision on that particular subject. Little Whistle Bourbon says, I remember reading this story as a kid and being disturbed by the cold-blooded mass murder of the bad guys. Yowza! I'd always hoped the World Beater or the Mad Scientist would have come back to face the Super Friends again. World Beater did come back at the very end of the series, I think, but not in any meaningful way. This was definitely Wendy and Marmon's greatest moment ever. Thank you, Little Russell. Jason Pope says, hi, Rob. Great show. Kudos to you and Michael. Wow, Ramona Freyden sure kicks up the art a couple of notches. Her work is dynamic and brings a smile to my face. It completely captures the Super Friends' friendliness and the heroic feel for the book. I'm looking forward to seeing more of her work going throughout the series. I was not surprised at all to see the World Beater appear on the JLA satellite, even with the JLA safety protocols on the teleporter. It was stated on a previous page that one of the villains that were disintegrated to combine into the World Beater, the Traveler, had the power of teleportation. I figure World Beater just had the power of teleportation and used it to gain access. Yes, Jason, that makes total sense, and that's a good no-prizing it. Reason I took it is that he beamed up is because he beams into the teleporter. But, of course, he could have just done that as well. So, yeah, that makes total sense. And then Jason also mentions, lastly, I wanted to say I really enjoyed the new Super Friends merch segment. It's a great addition to your whole Super Friends podcast package. Well done, and thanks. Well, thank you so much, Jason. You know, I always love talking to Chris. And I was happy to work him into any of my shows as much as I can. Maybe not Pod Dylan. But I always like working into my shows. And I was happy that he joined us for this episode as well. Doug Van Diver returns and he says, it sure is fortunate for the Junior Friends that the villain had the power he, one, hadn't used yet, two, would defeat himself by activating it, and three, failed him to disappoint, point two. Logically, the World Beater would have gotten around to that power sooner or later, regardless, wouldn't you think? A story ending with the Brave Kids deducing and exploiting that kind of convenient weakness is a tricky feat to pull off. The miraculous ENB's careful handling of the story's tone and Ramona Freyden's champion art give this comic just the right amount of magic that the ending doesn't undermine it. I'd also go so far as to say you could only pull off this kind of cartoon ending in the kind of cartoon and tie-in book that Birdwell and Freyden brought us. Totally agree, Doug. Ward Hill Terry says, I heartily endorse the inclusion of segments with Chris Winslow Franklin, which Chris replies, thanks, Terry, but I'll be honest, after all these podcasts, I feel shot. I know the joke doesn't work hearing it because it's a pun, depending on how you read it, but I wanted to include Ward Hill and Chris's comments. Sean M. Myers, who, of course, was on this very show in the first two episodes, says, such a great episode. I loved hearing Michael on Superman Movie Minute, and I'm very happy he is now reading the Super Friends comic. It was just so neat to hear his thoughts and feelings about the story we talked about earlier on Digest Cast. I'm so excited that Chris will be guesting on several upcoming episodes featuring the merchandise from Super Friends instead of just a very special episode or two. I'm eager to hear the discussion about the various things that I have amassed over the years. Yes, there is so much merchandise to cover that, like I said, I can't promise that the merch segment will be in every episode, but it will be a recurring feature because, as I said, there's just so much to discuss. Gothos Mansion says, Rob and Michael, I really enjoyed the show, if not the comic. Michael, if you enjoyed this one, you're in for a better ride ahead. This is probably my least favorite issue of the Super Friends series. Number 3 came out a few months after I began collecting, but I didn't get it. I wonder if it was due to Batman's absence on the cover or Wonder Woman's prominence. This is during my Girls Have Cooties period. I first discovered the story in the Super Friends Digest. I feel like this issue is the I've Got Batman in My Basement of the Super Friends comic. Even back when I was a kid, I didn't like it when the heroes were taken out only to be rescued by children. It makes the heroes look weak and makes World Beater seem like a weak villain. While I don't hate Marvin to the degree Chris does, I save that for Damian Wayne and Green Arrow, I'm not really fond of him either. I guess Wonder Dog is okay, but you're talking to a guy who has action figures of Ace the Bat Hound and Crypto in his collection, so I'm a fan of the Caped Canines. After being underwhelmed by this issue in the Digest, I got the original issue in one of the old comics collections in the Christmas catalog. That was a disappointment to get a story I'd already read and didn't like. I promised to be more positive next episode because Super Friends number 4 was the first issue of Super Friends I ever bought, new, and it is one of my favorites. I'm afraid I drew a Wonder Woman pinup for Wonder Woman number 750, which came out in February. Very Super Friends looking, and Miss Frayden still has artistic chops. I thought the Super Friends would like to know. I love the merch segment, and I'm looking forward to more of those. I just hope you don't send me to eBay in search of lost treasures from the 1970s. I didn't have the sheets that Chris had, but I had this DC blanket when I was a kid. Sorry, Rob, no Aquaman. I don't remember if it was branded as Super Friends. I got it for Christmas, so I'm sure I never saw the packaging. Now that I'm 48, I'm too old for superhero betting. So if you think I don't have a Batman blanket with Jose Luis Garcia Lopez, praise be his name, art, or a Batgirl Wonder Woman Supergirl blanket with Jose Luis Garcia Lopez, praise be his name, art, well, you'd be mistaken. I could say I get to go to bed with three beautiful women every night, but that might be considered sleazy, so I'll keep that to myself. Thank you, Gothos. And then finally, Mark Ross, a.k.a. Cluck Trent, says, great news, I just saw on DC Universe that the Super Friends issues are coming to that service. The first three issues will be up in March. That is great news. Thank you so much, Mark. I'm glad that these Super Friends comics are making their way into the digital domain. They should be. They're really a lot of fun, which, of course, is the whole point of the show. So thanks, everybody. Thanks for all those comments. It's great. It's really been getting a lot of great feedback for the show, and I very much appreciate it. So that is going to do it. Of course, we always are talking Super Friends over on Twitter, which is at ForAllMankindSF. You can see images from this issue on our website, fireandwaterpodcast.com. Just check the gallery post. And finally, if you want to support the network, go to patreon.com/FWPodcast. There you can unlock various rewards, one of which is to be name-checked on a favorite show from the network. So if you want to be mentioned here on For All Mankind, just leave us a monthly pledge, and you will get mentioned every episode here on the show. So that is going to do it. Thanks so much for the two Chrises for coming by. Chris from Professor Frenzy to talk about this issue, and then Chris, of course, for another segment of For All Merch Kind. So that is going to do it for this episode. Thanks for listening to For All Mankind, and join us next episode when we look at Super Friends number 5, Telethon Treachery.
An FWTV podcast.